Welcome to The Jewish Diasporist, a podcast exploring the political, social, and cultural implications of life in diaspora. We are your hosts, Zach Smerin
and Ben Yanowitz. We want to apologize for the delay in releasing this episode. Much of the organizing energy that has been fueling this passion project is now being split between various local, regional, and international projects. It's a good reason for delaying an episode. Nevertheless, the Jewish Diasporist is not going anywhere, and we look forward to the many exciting episodes we will release in 2025. Please stay tuned.
Enough of this Bund stuff for a change. Today, we're talking to Kofi, who recently took part in the Black Jewish Liberation Collective's Teshuvah Across the Waters, Solidarity and Educational Trip, the Hebrew Igbo Community in Nigeria.
As we discuss in the interview, the Igbo Jewish people is made up of dozens of communities across the country, numbering as many as 30,000 people or more. On their trip, the BJLC spent time engaging with the community in Ogidi, learning from them and drawing connections and inspiration for their own organizing as Black Jews from the United States.
We touch upon a variety of topics, including the experience of being part of both the African and Jewish diasporas with diverse understandings of homeland and colonial histories. We discuss similarities and differences between religious customs and communal structures, and given that the trip was advertised as being for Jews and Hebrews, we also spoke about Black Hebrew Israelite identity with a bit more nuance than the topic usually receives.
If you want to learn more about the BJLC's experience of Teshuvah Across the Waters, please check out the recent episode of Beyond the Pale with one of the trip's organizers, Rabbi Dr. Koach Frazier, and two other participants. We intentionally recorded this interview several days after their conversation was released, so that we could build on what they lay out. The link to that interview will be found in our description.
Thank you so much to all our audience and supporters. If you like what we do here and want to support grassroots diasporist media, please leave us a rating on your podcast platform of choice, consider supporting us on Patreon, follow us on Instagram, and share our content with your communities.
Without further ado, we hope you enjoy the conversation. To call ourselves to task, to sing what's good and true, to bring about redemption, it's what we were freed to do. For what's the point of being here if we're not moved to change our ways? Aleinu l'shabeach, it's time to live our praise. Kofi, it's really wonderful to sit down with you. I'm really looking forward to this conversation. We spoke a bit before you left on the trip, but now we're sitting a couple weeks after you've gotten back to your home. And the Black Jewish Liberation Collective had this trip that was called Teshuvah Across the Water, Return Across the Water. And it physically brought Black Jews, I believe it was around 30 Black Jews, back to Nigeria to connect with both African and Jewish identities. Of course, these are interconnected. Can you tell us a little bit about your own journey in relationship to these different elements of your identity and whether they're connected, disconnected, and perhaps how this trip added to this journey? I know that's a big question to start with. Could you tell us a bit about what brought you to be part of this trip and how this trip helped contribute to this ongoing story in your own life?
Yeah, of course. Thank you for having me. First and foremost, excited to be on the pod. I can't believe I just said pod. my Blackness is very interwoven and interconnected to my Jewish identity, of course. I think a little bit about my background, both professionally and personally, is that I lived in New York for a couple of years, and I ended up taking an internship at Jews for Racial and Economic Justice. And through working there, I met a handful of the folks who went on this trip with BJLC, BJLC being a sibling organization to JFREJ. You know, what brought me to JFREJ is that it had an explicit focus on racial identity, and it also had tons of Black Jewish folks. So when I saw that some of those people were helping organize this trip, I felt like I had to go. And yeah, some of what brought me to JFREJ brought me to this Nigerian trip. Just wanting to see myself in Jewish community. I have not been Jewish my whole life. I converted, and largely that experience was, I would say, hyper white. People might even say Ashkenormative. You know, J-Fridge, again, I saw tons of like folks of color, Black folks of color. I think when I was going to Nigeria, I was like, wow, you know, I'm feeling burned out being in Jewish community. You know, you might have heard this on the Beyond the Pale episode. Dr. Rabbi Kolk was like, I'm tired of being asked, how am I Jewish? You know, like every time I show up to shul, I don't even go to shul anymore for this reason. You know, I try to stick to like minyanim because they're smaller and more personal. I continuously feel like an outsider. And so I wanted to carve out space on this trip to come back to my Jewishness. And I think that's what it did for me. It showed me there are folks in parts of the world that are Black and Jewish and aren't having to prove themselves, aren't having to defend or articulate how they exist. They're just having Havdalah, you know, and it's all ages. Kids are just like living their best lives and families and folks are just doing their thing and being Black and Jewish. So it has brought me back to myself in a really rich way.
Yeah, I mean, I did listen to the Beyond the Pale episode, and it definitely seemed like that was a very clear intention of the organizers to be able to go to Africa and be with a Black Jewish community in order to kind of emphasize that there are Black Jewish communities. One thing they brought up a lot in that was just the lack of Jewish space that is made for Black Jews and Black Jewish communities in particular. I think even we're guilty of it because most of our connections have been white Jews. But it's really important for us to make space for Black Jews. It's a really clear problem when Black Jews do not feel like they are really seen as part of the community, that you're actually family rather than a stranger. And that was something right. that really struck me in that interview. If you're checking out this interview, you should definitely check that out. And we're going to link it in the description because we are seeing this as a continuation of that conversation. They said a lot of really important things, laying out the ways in which you engage with the communities that you engaged with. The Igbo community that you visited, the Hebrew Jewish community, is one that has a really long history. It's one that goes back to the 12 tribes, has been there for as long as we know. And of course, there is people that question that history. There's a lot of Europeans. I read on the Wikipedia page that, oh, these were people that were inspired by Alauda Equiano's trip, who said, oh, they were like Jews. And it's like, okay, that's extremely Eurocentric to say when this one person, of course he was a freed slave, but still, when this one person came and visited this community and made a comment, that was when they started being Jewish. That's not true at all. The conversation about Omanana was super fascinating. Could you say a little bit about the Igbo Jewish community's relationship to Jewishness, and also the Igbo people more broadly, and how you understand their relationship to Jewish identity and Jewish history?
You know, just to sort of address those comments from Wikipedia, I would also say, you know, like, I'll go into this more in detail, but how and why is it important, you know, as far as how and why people are Jewish? Like, I definitely do think it is important, but I would like to question why we think it's important, how we think it's important, when we think it's important. A lot of what came up for me on this trip is, you know, different declarations of Igbo people have been Jewish this whole time because of this reason, whether it's DNA or it's, you know, geographic, you know. It didn't matter to me. I thought it was interesting and compelling, but it didn't matter to me. And I think Rabbi B'nai Lathi of Apsara has said something that has been really resonant with me, which is like, I'm not so interested in, you know, how people are Jewish so much as like, who's doing Jewish. I saw them doing Jewish and that was enough for me. We had a couple of scholars who came to talk to us and community members. And so we had a Rosh from one of the shuls who describes the Igbo people's history of Judaism and Jewishness as dating back to the Torah, being a part of, like I said, the 12 tribes, becoming displaced, you know, over time developing or having a relationship with Judaism that became or was called Ominana. And some of the practices changed and morphed, but still resemble Judaism and Jewish ritual. And so how the Rosh explained it was that the Igbo folks eventually learned like, hey, like, we have been Jewish. Ominana is Judaism in many respects. And through British colonialism and other various complications, have moved away from Judaism, but now we're coming back. It is there. I don't want to say the word birthright, but like it's inherent to their practices and their lifestyles.
Like a cultural inheritance.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Oftentimes, in terms of like African Jewry, Ethiopian Jews will come up, but I think maybe more interestingly of a contrast is like the Ugandan Jews, who were largely like mass converted. What I saw and heard from like the Igbo Jewish community is like, we're not interested in that. So like, we don't actually need to convert because we're already Jewish and we already have that connection, which is something that I'm deeply interested in.
One of these things that is quite interesting to me is when, on the example of Igbo Jews, most people who are Jewish, who claim that they have had Jewish ancestry forever, they don't know. I don't know. And at least part of my family has been researched at least to the 18th century when it comes to the Jewish ancestry. A distant relative like did all the work in that regard. Mm-hmm. But I don't know what my ancestors did 500 years ago. I have even less of an idea of what my ancestors did 1,000 years ago. The people that do have that idea in the Jewish community today, I would say, are primarily people who come from like Hasidic aristocracy or rabbinical, like long traditions that can like, or have been extremely grounded in a certain area. And it's very clear that, you know, if they go through the cemeteries, then they will be able to do so. But even people that are descendants of Sephardi Jews, for example, when Sephardi Jews from Turkey or from Latin America apply for Spanish citizenship, it's my understanding, as having spoken to people that do it, they don't point out a particular ancestor. It's just that through enough contextual clues of their community and their background and history, they can like say, yes, my ancestors were expelled from Spain and Portugal in 1492 or whatever. So that's one thing. The second thing, and this has come up a few times on the podcast and a few times, you know, just in conversation outwise, but within mainstream Jewish communal organizations, there is, I think, a kind of unity among Jewish security guards of mainstream shuls. I don't know if they talk to each other about this, but like, treating black people and generally non-white people with suspicion, whether it be in the United States or in the United Kingdom or in South Africa. And I've heard, you know, of a few cases of that kind in Austria here locally as well. It's a form of Jewish unity. How nice. You've touched already on the subject of the mass conversion. That's something that's very interesting, you know, as well in that regard of like, do the Ugandan Jews need white Masorti or conservative or any other Jews from wherever to America or Israel or Britain to come and certify them as glatt kosher? And is that necessary? Like, does that bring with it certain advantages? Because in a practical way, for many of them, it does. I mean, there are even certain organizations like Shavei Yisrael that like make the effort of finding lost Jews around the world and then they like convert them, and that gives them like a ticket to make Aliyah, right? Mm-hmm. Which, you know, in the way that Nigerian Jews won't have that. I'm going to try not to speak too much about this because this isn't what the episode is about, and I mention it a lot. But when it comes to the trips from America for Jews that have their ancestral connections, one might say, you know, to ancestral homeland, however broadly that might be defined. When it comes to, you know, Raf Shimonov mentioned this in the podcast episode regarding his trip to Uzbekistan and Bukhara. And obviously, I'm very well acquainted in the Polish context of, in a lot of the ways in which, you know, they skip over the local Jewish community or they don't engage with the realities of Jewish life today. And people might not have the possibilities of visiting specifically the areas where their families come from, whether through lack of information or, you know, other factors. And so I think that there is, you know, in obviously very different circumstances, but I think something that could be, you know, reflected or put literally or figuratively in conversation, like how do these trips for Jews that some might want, you know, be interested in going back to Spain, some might be interested in going back to Poland or to Uzbekistan or to Nigeria. And I think that obviously there are many differences, but I think there are also certain parallels that are worth pointing out in that regard, and perhaps even ways in which people that have those connections to those communities might be able to learn from each other.
I mean, to share a little bit about myself personally, my earlier days, again, did not see myself reflected in Jewish community. And so I thought that the answer to that, the panacea, right, was like, I have to go to Israel because I know that there's going to be all types of folks and that Jewish diversity looks different, or at least, you know, that was my presumption. And I think a trip like, I mean, I can't speak to other trips, but I think a trip like what we did with Teshuva Across Waters shows a de-emphasizing of Israel as the center of Jewish life is possible. And that you don't have to make aliyah. You don't have to, you know, go to Israel. You can experience Jewish diversity and Jewish life in other places. I think that's an important project as far as like diasporism goes, for sure.
Obviously, on your trip, there were also people that came to this from quite different backgrounds as well. So there were people that had direct ancestral connection to Jewishness. There were people that came from, you know, mixed Jewish or African-American backgrounds. I think it's, when it comes to the question of Ashkenormativity, I'm obviously approaching this from a very like distant perspective. But of course, you know, because of intermarriage, there are Black Ashkenazi Jews, right?
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
So like, that's when we talk about Ashkenormativity from that perspective, like it shouldn't just be an equality sign that there are white Ashkenazi Jews, there are white non-Ashkenazi Jews and vice versa. So people came to this from very different perspectives. One of the things I wanted to ask, you know, you mentioned your conversion earlier, and do you think that that experience was reflected differently between different people that made that trip? Also, we're going to be working towards it, but also it's interesting, you know, in the question of for Jews and Hebrews and that sort of background as well that we can get into later.
You know, we had people of different, for lack of better phrasing, entry points into like their Jewish identities. And so we did have folks who were raised in various different ways and within different movements. We had folks who grew up Orthodox, Black and Jewish folks who grew up Orthodox. We had folks who grew up Reform and are currently in all various different places with their Jewishness and Jewish practice. And yes, we had people who converted, and we also had people who have maybe one Jewish parent, or we had people who had, you know, two Black Jewish parents. It really ran a wide array of expression and backgrounds. I think your question about Ashkenormativity and maybe the nuances that you're getting at is that Ashkenormativity looks, it rears its head more than just a white face, right? It can be also a Black face. It could also be, you know, whatever other face that presents itself. And I think that's interesting. I have a lot to say about that, and I would just like ping pong around. I think one thing that's interesting with the Igbo Jewish community is that in some ways they are Ashkenormative, but they also aren't. Like their Nusach is definitely Sephardic. I tried to ask questions and follow up questions about how and like, you know, the origin of that story. I didn't necessarily get a clear one, but I thought about the tension, if there was one, of like us with largely like Ashkenazi, you know, backgrounds, you know, whether we converted or not. And what that meant in terms of like service, you know, in terms of like how we davened with them. And I also think about that a lot in terms of the US and like some of the spaces that we carve out. By Joxum is something that I've been thinking about pretty critically. And what does it mean to sort of like lump Jews of color with Sephardic and like Mizrahi Jews? And why we're in the room is often different. Like one might be because maybe trying to move away from Ashkenormativity in the ways that I'm in like dominating spaces. And then the other one is like, well, I want to see people who have my same skin or like, you know, phenotypically resemble me. There's a lot that came up for me in terms of like thinking about Ashkenormativity. And I'm definitely curious to have a conversation about how to challenge it, move away from it, or at least think about it more critically.
In that Beyond the Pale interview, they talked about the ways in which Jewish communities, I'm going to say on the periphery of diaspora, for example, like in Uzbekistan or Nigeria, that are really off the like main map of Jewish tourism, I guess you could say it. They argued that it's been like colonized by a hegemonic form of Jewishness, which I could say is like Orthodoxy, Ashkenormativity, Zionism. And thinking about how the Jewish community that you engaged with, or the Jewish communities that you engaged with in Nigeria, how did those manifest? How did this hegemonic form of Jewishness manifest? But also, before we quite get to that, how were you received as like a tour group? Were you welcomed with open arms? Were they really curious? Were there conversations that was like a really radical intercultural exchange? What did that look like?
I think first and foremost, we were received as family, you know, which again, to reference the Beyond the Pale episode, you know, that's the difference between being welcomed as a stranger in your own community versus being welcomed as kin. No one batted an eye, first of all, and sort of remarked like, who are you people? Like, you know, what's your deal? If I'm thinking specifically about the Jewish communities we were in, we were also in other non-Jewish communities as well. I mean, we traveled with security, you know, for the most part. So I think I wish that I could speak to how the folks who were living in Nigeria, how they received that. I'm not sure. We didn't really talk about it. But I think the conversation among us as folks mostly coming from the US was, one, a place of privilege, but also a place of either explicit disconnect or concern about disconnect. What does it mean for us to have been in community and like bring people who are armed? I think, yeah, still we were pretty well received and treated well, but there is something to be said about it that I think I'm still processing in terms of like American privilege and just the ways that we thought things should be one way and they weren't.
Could you give an example of what you mean by that?
Yeah. I think like this is maybe getting to your point about like orthodoxy and Ashkenormativity as well. It's like we had folks who were gender expansive, queer folks, genderqueer folks of different backgrounds, and going to an Orthodox service for some of us was pretty new. You know, like some of us hadn't been in a while, and they didn't necessarily have like a mechitza like when we were there, but it was like, there were a couple of times we went to shul. I didn't go every time, but one of the first times, I think people who were ascribed like women or ascribed the role of women were to stand on a balcony, you know, while the men were on the ground floor davening. And I think that the women were mostly expected to be quiet and just observe. And one of the times that I went to shul, the people who were, you know, read as male were in the front, you know, near the bima, while the women were in the back. A lot of conversation came up about like, what does that mean? Like, do we come and challenge that? Because most of us aren't Orthodox and, you know, most of us aren't like Nigerian citizens. Do we say, hey, we do this differently? Or do we sort of fall into the roles neatly as tourists, you know, and whatever it means to be a respectful tourist? And so ultimately we went with whatever roles we were given. And there was actually a really special moment of, you know, I went to services and, you know, everyone's around the front just dancing, who's like male presenting. And I'm looking back and I'm like, fuck, like, you know, some of the people I care about are in the back and they're not doing anything. They're just watching us. And that feels really fucked up. It is really fucked up for me personally. I don't want to speak for everyone. And then they just started dancing, you know, and they started dancing and singing. And I heard feedback from that in person. And I also think on the other podcast that like folks rolled with it, you know, like, and it was fine. So there's a delicate balance, but I think we definitely struggled to figure out what to do and how to exist, but it felt seamless at the same time.
I have strong feelings about the idea of tourism and travel in this way, because I try to recompense the idea behind, on one hand, I personally believe that freedom of movement and freedom of where to live is something that's very important and should be treated basically as a human right. You should be able, you know, the world's a big place, and if you want to live somewhere else, then you should have the right to do that. If you want to visit someplace else, I think that should be the right of everyone in that way. However, on the other hand, it's also clear that a lot of the ways in which mass tourism works is very damaging towards local communities. And if you have places that are particularly designed for being dependent on tourists, that in many ways can turn, you know, actual communal spaces into like Disneylands, you know, that are not suitable for living. I think there is a way that you can square the circle if you do have possibilities of traveling and you connect with the community in a local way that isn't necessarily tourism, even if it is a lot of people like traveling. So I'd be interested in comparing thoughts on you guys. Just one question that I had from earlier when you mentioned davening and the mechitza and the gender divide is one thing, but I'll ask also sort of from my perspective, because I grew up in the Reformed tradition. So, and part of that Reformed tradition for me and for my father, he very much didn't believe in gender segregation, but he did like hearing Hebrew. Like he did like the intonation. He didn't like everything just being in English, for example. And the knowledge that you can go into synagogues all over the world and still hear many of the same melodies in the same language and, you know, follow them in that way was something that appealed to him. And so I know my way around mostly Reform synagogues, some liberals, and I've, you know, visited more and more Orthodox stuff in recent years, even like once or twice Chabad. And I always try to like follow in the Hebrew only siddurs that they are. And I usually lose my space and I have to like skip and wait until they get to that, because I know that this will be coming up. But so from this kind of perspective, I assume that there are, you know, you said people have disconnected feelings or do not attend synagogues or, you know, secular, I mean, from different sides. But if someone were to be from that sort of, just for the sake of simplifying, let's take it from like the Jewish American, let's even sort of make it Ashkenormative mainstream, and they were placed in that synagogue, would they be able to follow more or less like what's going on in that service, or are there enough similarities, and what are the differences in terms of like the melodies and what is included, what isn't? Just asking that in terms of like placing us in these synagogues, these rites. A lot of places have very unique things, and be very interesting, you know, if there are certain ways that things are done in Nigeria and in Nigerian Jewish communities.
I mean, my answer to that is pretty brief, but I would say that as someone who is used to Ashkenazi davening and services, if you find yourself able to show up to, you know, Sephardic services, you can follow the Igbo Jewish community services. A lot of the services, actually almost, exclusively in Hebrew. I would also say, yeah, for myself, I did something similar to you. I'm like, okay, I know like from Ashkenazi davening and what I'm used to that, like, I'm going to listen for these certain, you know, lyrics or, you know, whatever. And like, I'll be able to pick it up and find out where we are in the Siddur. That was the experience I had there. There are certain melodies that are original to their community, but for the most part, I felt like it's pretty grounded in both, I would say even a hybrid of Ashkenazi and Sephardic Nusach, for sure.
Thank you for that. No, I think that's a really interesting question to delve into, and I'd love to like get to know some of those melodies, because I'm sure there's beauty and uniqueness in every Jewish community, and it's exciting to hear the ways in which communities bring their own melodies and instrumentations to a service. And of course, some services have no instruments and no music. And personally, I don't find that too engaging, but it's always lovely to think about and hear the ways that that plays out.
I meant to say that objectively, the best way that I've encountered in Britain, which is where you say like the first two lines and then you mumble through the rest of the and then everybody pretends that they're mumbling along the text, and then they go back to the final two sentences.
Yeah.
No music. It's just that throughout the whole thing.
Right.
So, yeah,
and wait for a Nagoon to jump in or something.
Yeah. You know, I'm joking a little bit, but that's the kind of, you know, stuff that I encountered as well. Yeah. Sorry, go on.
I was just going to go back to the BJLC, because the Black Jewish Liberation Collective is a very specific type of Jewish community. I mean, it's, from what you've told us, it's primarily online, but I mean, I think you said it was kind of a big tent politically, but it's in general on the left, mostly anti non-Zionist type folks, correct me if I'm wrong there. Mm-hmm. And it's like very much a Black Jewish community, which there's not a ton of in the United States in particular. But when you step into a Nigerian Jewish community, and as we've said, it's been shaped by a sort of hegemonic Judaism that is Orthodox, that still leans toward Ashkenormativity, even if it is a Nigerian Jewish community. And of course, it does unfortunately lean towards Zionism. I was kind of curious how you, as a traveling group with the BJLC, engage with these spaces, if there was a kind of give and take. I know we've spoken a little bit already about how you engage with the Orthodoxy and a little bit on the Ashkenormativity point. But how was the experience of being in that space? And was there a political dialogue going on? Was there a cultural dialogue going on? Was it more of you just kind of being in the space and having the conversation? Or was there more like serious exchange between the communities that you were in and the group you were with?
Yeah. When you ask about like political conversation, are you a imagining one in particular? Like, are you thinking about Zionism? Because we were having conversations explicitly about politics, but, you know, a lot of that looked like maybe class or gender. You know, specifically, mm-hmm. I remember a few conversations between, you know, both the BJLC cohort and, you know, some of the Nigerian Igbo folks about, like, the role of people who are deemed women, you know, and yeah. their communities and what they're able to do and not do. Some of that was described as, you know, as we talked about, as women being very empowered. And I think some among the BJOC cohort, you know, had questions about that. Like, what does empowerment look like for these women? We didn't really hear from many folks who weren't men. Mm-hmm. In terms of like them speaking for themselves and saying, this is actually how we feel about X, Y, and Z. That just wasn't a part of it. So these were men who were telling us that, you know, the women feel empowered and run the show. So take mm-hmm. that for what it is. Mm-hmm. I also do want to push a little bit back toward, you know, this idea that Orthodox women, Jewish Orthodox women are inherently oppressed. You know, I've had conversations about NIDA, you know, which for listeners is surrounded in purity laws, and, you know, conversations about menstruation. So what that would look like is, like, you know, making sure that the person who's menstruating is away from the community for the most part, and, you know, not sleeping in the same bed as their partner. And in some communities, like, even being checked physically, you know, by some third party to make sure that they're, you know, not menstruating anymore. You know, heard of yeah. this is why it's good to see each other's face. I've heard a range, you know, of how people relate to that. I think, like, in a lot of spaces, people would readily say that feels very oppressive and harmful. And I've also heard firsthand from people who practice NIDA that it is very powerful for them and empowering. And so I think, like, in terms of, let's talk about, like, tourism, right? And part of the issue of tourism can be that you bring your own perspective, especially as a Westerner, to other places, and that you sort of overlay your political outlook onto what their community and what their political landscape looks like. So I'm not necessarily one who's advocating for, like, you know, whatever, but at the same time, I think I want to hold intention, like, how we talk about, you know, communities that might present themselves as the Igbo Jewish community and, you know, in their orthodoxy, if that makes sense. So that's as far as gender politics. And then as far as Zionism goes, there was a pre-dinner conversation that sort of rounded out our, like, roughly 2-week trip, where someone directly was like, what about Zionism? Like, do you guys support Israel? You know, in some ways, part of what I heard from folks was, we're not concerned with Israel, you know, we're not concerned with, you know, Poland. We're not concerned with, like, what we're doing is sort of different, you know. And in some ways, I feel like I've heard, maybe we'll get into this author, but Remy Alona, hopefully I'm pronouncing his name correctly. He has, you know, in his book, one of his books, where it's like, here's this, you know, Israeli scholar who, like, affirms my research, or, you know, something like that, where it's like, not necessarily Zionism, but it's like, one might make it an argument that it's Zionist, if that makes sense.
You've mentioned the political context a little bit, and there's two avenues that I think might be interesting to explore with that. And these are not directly linked to Jewish context, although in some ways it is, because when we talk about Igbo identity in Nigeria, I mean, a significant part of it is still colored by the Biafran War and Igbo secessionism that is considered, to some extent, a danger by the Nigerian government. I kind of want to ask, you know, in terms of Jewish trips to Nigeria, mm-hmm. unfortunately, the one that is most known recently in the, like, wider Jewish world wasn't the trip that you guys made, but the trip by Rudy Rochman, where he ended up getting arrested. And I don't know, for people with context for this, Rudy Rochman is, like, a pro-Israel influencer of, you know, and got quite famous recently of reclaiming the traditional ancient Israelite garb of the Sudra, which looks suspiciously much like a keffiyeh. And yeah, I mean, he's, you know, if you don't know who Rudy Rochman is, that's fine. Many people do know. And that's, like, they were filming a documentary, look it up. So was that something that was mentioned, you know, with the communities that you had? Like, no? Uh-huh. That's probably for the better in that regard. If you want to look up this story, it's quite farcical, exactly what happened there. And the second thing is, you know, we mentioned a little bit on the regarding different people's identities coming into this trip. And one thing that I did mention to come back to, we haven't mentioned yet on the podcast, I think, the Black Hebrew Israelite identity as such. And I must admit, when it comes to what that comes across as mainstream Jewish identity, or mainstream Jewish consciousness, it's mainly associated with hate groups, right? I mean, there was the whole thing with Kyrie Irving not too long ago, and like the documentaries that come with that, and sometimes even neo-Nazis like make this thing of like, these are the real Jews and blah, 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 right? That, as far as I understand, and I remember reading about this like when this was more connected in public discourse, a large part of Black Hebrew Israelites are completely unassociated with like hate group identity. And some have, I know Rabbi Capus Fune, I think, in Chicago, spoke about this in The Colors of Jews, the book by Melanie K. Kantrowitz, that there is, that he's been like involved in dialogue between what might, again, I don't want to say like mainstream Jewish denominations, congregations, and like Black Hebrew Israelites, like at least to have some sort of dialogue involved. But how was that identity and part of the discussion of the trip, or did it not come up at all, and like people not really paying attention to that in this context?
Yeah, that context or the conversation around Black Hebrew Israelites definitely came up. One of the first, I would say, more overtly religious experiences that we had on the trip was going to shul to meet a Rosh, and he like sort of outlined this whole narrative rooted in Torah, and I'm not a Torah scholar, so I want to preface by saying that.
That's fine. Both of us are, so we'll just make sure that you're not saying anything wrong.
Okay. He had a story of Israelites weren't enslaved in Egypt. And he sort of like pulls from the Talmud, and I'm trying to remember the tractate, but he says that there are at least three things in as far as what are listed in the tractate that qualify someone as a slave. Based on Egyptian slavery and enslavement, all three of these things don't qualify. And then he goes on to say, but if we think about other groups, other worldly peoples, you know, there's a, maybe you can tell me this to lean on you for your Torah scholarship. There's a prophecy of a certain amount of years that people are supposed to be enslaved, and like those people will be, I wish I could remember it. But basically he says African folks fit the prophecy, right? And he's like, we fit the prophecy of enslavement and the people who will be freed. And I bring that up to say that I remember people going, oh, this reminds me of the Black Hebrew Israelites, you know, as far as like the overlapping conversation of like, you know, Black folks are, a Black Hebrew Israelite would say, the real, quote unquote, real Jews. And I think that this prophecy that he was talking about, you know, people had their doubts about, well, of course, what happened in Egypt was enslavement and like, you know, so on and so forth. Yeah, that was a part of the conversation. And I think even to me, what I do know about Black Hebrew Israelite thought, I would say, yeah, there are themes, you know, like also interestingly enough, I think part of what was going on is like that manifested itself in terms of a disregard for rabbinic Judaism. And so, you know, while they do follow some like halacha, and, you know, other things that are definitely rooted in like rabbinic Judaism, the Rosh who spoke to us that day also considered themselves more akin to like Karaite Jews, you know, and being more like Torah based and not necessarily focused on halacha. So yeah, it was a part of the conversation. And I do believe that there are people in our cohort who are actively in dialogue and relationship with folks who are Hebrew Israelites. And yeah, I mean, you know, it manifests itself in many ways. I wouldn't say that all, largely in the public imagination, Hebrew Israelites are, you know, a hate group. And they're the people who stand outside on corners and yell at people and, you know, whatever. But that I would say is maybe a small portion to my understanding. And there are a lot of other folks who are just like, not that. To put it lightly, yeah, who are more chill and not having those conversations, who are just like, we're Jewish, we're Israelites. We believe we always have been, which is the overlap between the Igbo community. And we're doing Judaism based on the Torah. And they're not necessarily being like hateful.
Just for your information, both you, Kofi, and our listeners, the Jewish study and the Jewish diaspora Torah scholar department has a 14 working days response. So we'll get back to you about that at some point. I was thinking about Karaite Judaism as you were mentioning that, and we might actually be having one person specifically to speak about that in the near future. So if people are listening, then stay tuned for that, because that's also a perspective that we haven't covered yet at this stage.
No, I was really appreciating what you had to say about the Black Hebrew Israelite community and how it does have a little bit of parallels with the Igbo community, just because, as we talked about, like, there is such a understanding in the public consciousness that, like, these are not Jews. They deny our Jewishness, so they're a hateful group. But, like, I think it's important to recognize the nuances and to kind of come in with a bit more of an open mind than that, especially in relationship to the actual Hebrew Jewish community here. Is there any sort of relationship, like, socially, organizationally, between like Black Hebrew Israelite communities in diaspora and like Igbo Jewish communities in Nigeria and other parts of Africa? I'm just curious.
I'm not aware of any standing relationships in that way. If we're thinking about internationalism in relation to being US-centric, the only version of that that I know of is Black Hebrew Israelites in Israel who have connections with folks in the US. But as far as Nigeria goes, or, you know, the wider African continent, I'm not sure.
Following on that, has this trip allowed you to develop the connections, you know, between the communities that will be able to lead to like more, maybe not necessarily like institutional, but like channels of communication, maintaining knowledge, you know, whatever might be interesting for people both in Nigeria and in the United States and everywhere else to promote culture exchanges, dialogues, events, etc. Has that been part of the discussion?
I can tell you that BJLC is definitely interested in continuing Teshuva Across Waters as a multi-trip series, you know, with the intention of continuing that dialogue and continuing those relationships. I think they're in the process of trying to continue to fund. Even before this iteration of the trip, you know, there were people who were a part of the organizing team for the trip to Teshuva Across Waters who have long-standing, like multi-year relationships with the Nigerian Igbo Jewish community or communities. And that's what made the trip possible, you know? There's one person in particular who had been going back and forth, I think for at least a couple of years, just connecting with the people who showed us around and invited us into their communities. And so I want to touch again on tourism and say, you know, we were tourists, but I think because of the work that this person did and building those relationships, it felt a lot less sterile than if we were to just go on like a, you know, we talked about A Real Pain, the movie. It was much emotionally, it was a lot more intimate than that trip. You know, it was like, not all of us knew everyone who was there, but there were a handful who like had already developed those relationships and felt like family. Like they referred to each other as family. At times I was like, wow, y'all must really be cousins, you know, because they were so close. So those exchanges are happening. And I also want to mention that like, a lot of the people who I met personally at Shul, and I heard this from other people on the trip, really did welcome us with open arms, and they made an intention to connect with us. You know, I saw a lot of like folks from the Igbo Jewish community approach people and be like, hi, how are you? And immediately do like info exchanges. You know, like I got several people's numbers and have been, you know, WhatsApping people. A lot of those conversations that I've had with folks back in Nigeria had been like, you know, how do you daven? This is how I daven. And that's ranging to just like, how are you doing? And are you okay? So definitely conversation and connection is still ongoing.
That's beautiful to hear that the kind of bridges are being built and they're working to make them sustainable. I mean, it's very challenging to keep a almost entirely virtual relationship going, but hearing that there's going to be trips to go back, I mean, I heard in the Beyond the Pale interview, there's around 70 Jewish communities throughout Nigeria. And that's about almost 30,000 Jewish identifying Igbo people. And like, that's a pretty sizable number. I mean, Poland has maybe 15,000 at this point, according to the most recent census. And it's fascinating to be able to actually connect with a community when you go to a place. It's one thing to like just sightsee. It's an entire another thing to actually engage with the communities, meet people, build relationships. And it's so valuable. It does feel to me like building these relationships is the first step to building an actual alternative to Zionism, to building a voice for the Jewish people rooted in diaspora, wherever we live. Mm-hmm. I do want to raise one final question. I know you have to go kind of soon, Kofi. We started this podcast in the spring of 2023. I was also doing a placement at the Black Cultural Archives in London, and I was doing a project basically creating like a library guide for their collection on the Black Power movement, which meant that I was engaging a lot with materials from the Black Power movement of the late 60s and early 70s in the UK, which was a little different from the American iteration of the movement because they understood basically everyone that is not white is black. It wasn't about the color of one's skin, but about one's relationship to colonial white power. And of course, there was splits in the movement. There were all these different organizations that had slightly different understandings of blackness, some that really asserted that Africa was a spiritual homeland for black peoples. Others were like, well, what about India? Because South Asians don't have the same kind of relationship to Africa. And of course, there was so many different understandings of it. But one thing that really I started to think about was diasporism, Jewish diasporism, with its many different homelands and its many different ways of being Jewish, could be understood as like similar to the Black Power movement. And I started to think about the Black Power movement as potentially like Black diasporism. And the sort of parallels in terms of relating to cultural slash spiritual homeland elsewhere, whether that's in Poland or Spain or Nigeria or Palestine, and the assertion that we belong here where we are, saying that we can have relationships to other land that don't say that that is where our true home is. Our true home is here, and we want to fight for our right to be here while maintaining and furthering our own cultural and communal life. So I just wanted to put that idea out there because it's not something I'd said on this podcast before. But I was kind of wondering, just to kind of close out this conversation, how did your time in Nigeria impact the way you understand Black liberation, both in Africa and the Black diaspora?
Yeah, what a question to close out on. I mean, in many ways, the trip sort of like maybe buttressed things that I already believed about Black liberation. I could say like liberation is maybe continuous and not a destination. It's full of multiple practices and moments and episodes. And maybe this trip was a part of that, you know? And the ways that we were treated in terms of, I think you mentioned like part of what you came across was like anyone was Black who was against like white colonial power structure. What I experienced there in terms of Blackness was like, not necessarily, I don't want to flatten it and say, oh, we were just all Black. Like that was the end of the story. But there was a connection and a connectivity and a freeness, you know, that felt liberating. Part of the trip, we went to Badagry, which is one of two of Nigeria's slave ports. And, you know, we went largely as Black American Jews, but, you know, we also were guided by Nigerian Jews who had never been to the port. Some of them had never been to the port before. Part of what happened there is like we all are in real time witnessing like the connectivity of, you know, Blackness as created by the transatlantic slave trade. And this is moving a little bit away from what you're asking, but I do want to note what's interesting there too is that among us as Black Americans, we were talking a lot about like some people at the port were asking like some of the Nigerian folks, like, how are you reacting to this? We know how we feel, right? As people who, you know, live in the States, and what is it bringing up for you? And I remember having conversations where it was like, we don't just like have a harder time as, you know, Black Americans figuring out our lineages because of the transatlantic slave trade. We were experiencing real time that, you know, Nigerian folks lost their cousins, their aunts, their uncles. And there's that other side of it too. And part of what we heard when we were is like the complications of that, you know, for their communities. That part of the trip was definitely connective and liberating. And it just showed me like also Black liberation. You know, it's like it's so hard to talk about. But I think that what the trip showed me is that there's a way of being in relation that is definitely freeing from maybe some of the suspicions that are rooted in white supremacy, maybe some of the ways of just connecting to people. It just feels like the entry point was a lot easier to connect.
There was a second part of that question that I want to touch on, and we can really close out on this one. But I was also wondering how this trip impacted the way you understand how colonization affected the Jewish world as well. Maybe I shouldn't say affected. It's actively affecting the Jewish world as well.
The Nigerian Jewish communities that I experienced largely in Ogidi, Anambra State, Nigeria, they're like relatively autonomous. And, you know, like people can make claims about touch points of colonization and, you know, things of that nature. But what I experienced there is that they are, you know, doing their own thing. And it feels very informed by their own cultures and identities. It feels like it honors who they are. And maybe there's an argument for a touch point of, oh, well, that was started by, you know, someone who had, you know, X, Y, and Z. But what I saw was independent and joyous.
Just one final clarifying questions. And one of the things that does interest me is, in many ways, when we talk about Jewish diaspora and Jewish communities in the 21st century, it's overwhelmingly urban. And so when we talk about, you know, the urban landscape, how cities are designed, how does that impact Jewish communities? Of course, it has a very, very big impact. And so ways in which people navigate that, you know, not simply being centered around maybe like religious buildings, but what is a Jewish community like? And so that's my question. When we speak about these communities in Nigeria, you know, dozens of them, tens of thousands of Jews, are they in the larger towns? Are they in smaller towns and villages? Are they separated from, you know, non-Jews? What are their interactions like? What do they do? Like, what do Jewish Nigerians do, like, in terms of their daily lives? Like, what do they work as such? And this is like a very broad demographic question, but I think that it's not something that's included in the Wikipedia page or like the basic information. And just like getting to know that from that perspective would be beneficial to our understanding of the Nigerian Jewish community. Like, do they have eruvs around their places? You know, do they have to like live close if we are talking about like that Orthodox stuff? So
So again, you know, limited perspective, but what we were told was there's roughly about 70 or so, maybe 70 plus synagogues. And we visited two, but for the two that we visited, they were pretty rural. They were in very rural places. Ogidi in particular was, to sort of paint the landscape, in contrast to like urbanism, you know, many of the roads weren't paved. You know, they were dirt roads, red dust. A lot of the homes that I saw were very small and maybe made by the community themselves, you know, many of them. When I did talk to people at shul, you know, and I would ask them, you know, where are you coming from? Where do you live? Many of them could say like, oh yeah, I'm just up the street, you know, or, you know, I'm just around the corner. I would say, as we talked about at the top of this episode, like it is a relatively vast community, and I can't speak to the landscape for the overwhelming majority, but for the communities that we saw, they were mostly rural communities. You brought up the Biafran War. A lot of it is definitely connected to, I want to say, overlapping Igbo oppression, I would imagine, you know, in terms of like living in some of these rural communities. And also just like for folks' understanding, like the overwhelming religious landscape is, you know, you have, I believe, like a mostly like Muslim, you know, majority in the north of Nigeria. And then you have a relatively overwhelming Christian population in the south. And so I think someone once told us, like, you know, for their census purposes, like there's not a lot of like options to pick in terms of your religious identity. It's either Muslim, Christian, or other, you know? And so I think that's what I can speak to as far as landscape. And as far as like Orthodoxy and like how their community is set up with like Erevim, I was really looking for that and I could not see one. It is possible that I overlooked it, but I don't think that they had them. Yeah, I didn't see them at all. So maybe some of the other communities might use them, but I didn't see them from where I was.
There's so much more that we could go into here. I mean, when you speak of this rural landscape, it raises questions. You know, to use an Ashkenormative term, like, are these shtetls? Like, in that way, right? If we're talking about, like, Jewish localities with Jewish majorities in the diaspora, the ones that, you know, people think of that go down the Wikipedia rabbit hole on this sort of stuff is Kiryas Yoel in upstate New York and the Red Village in Azerbaijan. Like, is there more? Like, is that the sort of way in which we might be looking at these places? But we'll have to round it up over there for tonight. Thank you so much for joining us. It was really a pleasure speaking to you, hearing your perspective. And I know our listeners well enough that they appreciate it as well. Is there anything else that is worth mentioning that we haven't yet that you would like to finish off the conversation on?
Yeah. I mean, again, thank you for having me. It is a complete honor. I think the thing that is really resonant that I want to end on is just, you know, this trip for me, it brought up a lot of joy and excitement about Jewish futurity and what will Jewish ritual and practice look like in the future? What will Jewish peoplehood look like in the future? I've listened to several podcasts of people who are quote unquote more qualified to speak to that. And, you know, I think the conversation can be polarizing and it can be, you know, whether we want to stay rooted in something established, for example, halakha, or do we want to move away and sort of experiment and change? And I just really appreciated so much about this trip, but I liked seeing and really appreciated seeing people, I feel weird saying allowing themselves, but I'm going to say allowing themselves to build out their Jewish relationships in a way that doesn't feel prescriptive. Again, this is a return. Overarchingly, it's described as a return to Judaism for them. What I see is largely the Nigerian Jewish community shaping that for themselves and not so much being fixated on, like, well, how do we do it so that other people think we're actually serious about this? You know, they're doing it for themselves, and it's a beautiful return to see and witness.
That's absolutely beautiful. And I think really core to a diasporist approach to Judaism, finding a way that feels right for you and not trying to fit into a box of hegemonic Judaism, whatever forms it takes. Mm-hmm. And it's such an inspiring story to hear. And I'm so grateful for the work that the Black Jewish Liberation Collective has done to make this trip possible. And I'm really excited to hear where they go from here, because it sounds like this is just the beginning. And the future is wide open.
Thank you all so much.
Thank you so much for joining us, Kofi.
To call ourselves to task, to sing what's good and true, to bring about redemption, it's what we were freed to do. For what's the point of being here if we're not moved to change our ways? Aleinu l'shabeach. It's time to live our praise. We are carrying the stories of the ones who came before. What stories will be told of us when we are here no more? We commit ourselves to action. It brings meaning to our days. Aleinu l'shabeach. It's time to live our praise. It's up to us to own the vision. We are an answer to a call. It's up to us to live the words we speak for the benefit of all. It's up to us to bow down deeply. There's a broken world to raise. Aleinu l'shabeach. It's time to live our praise. Aleinu l'shabeach. It's time to live.